content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the June 27th, 2014 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Islamic militants advanced toward Baghdad. What happened? President Obama was facing one of his biggest foreign policy decisions of his presidency this week as an Islamist militant army in Iraq continued its bloody advance toward Baghdad. After seizing the nation's second largest city, Mosul, and other towns in the cities in the Sunni-dominated north, thousands of fighters from al-Qaeda, offshoot of the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, ISIS, reached the outskirts of Bakuba, just 37 miles north of the Iraqi capital. The Sunni extremists, who want to set up a caliphate straddling Syria and Iraq, released photos and videos purportedly showing hundreds of captured Iraqi soldiers being marched to their executions. The embattled government of Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, a Shiite, formally asked the U.S. to launch airstrikes against ISIS targets. Obama immediately ruled out the deployment of ground troops, but sent 275 troops to protect the American embassy in Baghdad, and said he was looking at a range of other options. He also insisted that any military action would be conditional on al-Maliki accepting major political reform that would give Sunnis a greater share of power in national government. If the U.S. does use fighter planes or drones, it would almost certainly have to work either directly or indirectly with the 2,000 ground troops Iran sent to the region, along with an elite military commander. Obama insisted that whatever aid the U.S. provides, it is ultimately up to the Iraqis, as a sovereign nation, to solve their problems. What the editorial said: if the war on terror is over, ISIS didn't get the message, said the Wall Street Journal. Despite Obama's claim that al-Qaeda is largely defeated and it's now safe to withdraw from the Middle East, ISIS is well on its way to creating an Islamist-controlled region that will become a breeding ground for terrorists who would inevitably target Americans. Yet, as ever, Obama is doing nothing. What's needed now is a show of force. A squadron of Apache attack helicopters, Predator drones, and A-10 attack planes would make ISIS think twice about marching on Baghdad. There are no good options, said the Baltimore Sun. Airstrikes would help Iranian troops prop up al-Maliki's teetering Shiite government, giving Tehran yet more influence over Iraq. Any military action against ISIS would also directly benefit Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad, who is fighting the group in his own country. Do we really want to be aiding Assad and the Ayatollahs? Airstrikes are pointless if the Iraqi army is incapable of defending the country, said the New York Times. The only solution to this civil war is to address the sectarian divisions at the heart of it. And for that to happen, Iraq's leaders need to oust the divisive al-Maliki. What the columnist said: after this initial blitzkrieg, the Sunni rebellion will backfire, said Stephen Simon in the New York Times. Despite the mass desertions in the north, the army still vastly outnumbers the extremists, 250,000 troops to 7,000 fighters, and Baghdad will be fiercely defended, with Shiite militias joining in. In all likelihood, the insurgency will fail, and the Sunnis will be even more isolated than before. That's why Iraq needs to be partitioned, not propped up, said Lauren Thompson in Forbes.com. This is a nation whose borders were arbitrarily drawn up almost a century ago by British officials who knew little about the people that lived there. Iraq's Shiites, Sunnis, and Kurds clearly can't peacefully share power, so why not let them form their own states? Unfortunately, domestic politics preclude any sensible response to Iraq's meltdown, said Clive Crook in BloombergView.com. 3 years ago, Obama declared victory in Iraq. Sending in fighter planes now would be a humiliating admission that he was wrong. Republicans, meanwhile, invariably demand a military victory and attack the cautious realism and strategic patience that is the foundation of any sane anti-terrorism policy. That's the danger of oversimplifying complex matters. Politicians can end up trapped by their own sound bites. It's an open question whether U.S. politics are capable of delivering the foreign policy the country needs. Our controversy of the week, Iraq. Who's responsible for this mess? It is hard to imagine a bigger disaster for American foreign policy, said Max Boot in CommentaryMagazine.com, or a more self-inflicted one. Iraq is now crumbling as the black-clad jihadis of the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, ISIS, have seized control of the Sunni regions of the country and are headed toward Shiite-held Baghdad. This Sunni-Shiite civil war, which threatens to engulf the entire nation, is vivid proof of the folly of President Obama's decision to withdraw all U.S. troops from Iraq in 2011. If Obama had tried harder to negotiate a status of forces agreement with Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, he probably would have succeeded. Then al-Maliki would not have been left to his worst autocratic impulses, which led him to marginalize the Sunni minority. That oppression led directly to the current backlash from the Sunnis and ISIS. Obama grandiosely bragged in 2011 that we were leaving behind a sovereign, stable, and self-reliant Iraq, said Corey Schack in foreignpolicy.com, and that he'd fulfilled his campaign promise to end the war. The truth, as we're seeing in savage detail, was that the war in Iraq hadn't ended at all. We just quit fighting it. You're blaming the wrong president, said Steve Chapman in ChicagoTribune.com. It was George W. Bush who, in 2008, signed the pledge to withdraw all troops by the end of 2011, not Barack Obama. And Bush did so at the insistence of the Iraqi government. Al-Maliki knew that most Iraqis were sick of U.S. soldiers in their streets, and that telling us to get out would enhance his popularity. And if we're assigning blame for the ugliness we've unleashed, it was Bush and Dick Cheney who charged into Iraq in pursuit of Saddam Hussein's non-existent weapons of mass destruction, with no understanding of Iraq's internal politics and sectarian divisions, or the immense difficulty of constructing a stable order in an alien land. From that one fateful, terrible decision, more than a decade of carnage and chaos has flowed. Ultimately, Nouri al-Maliki lost Iraq, said Fareed Zakaria in WashingtonPost.com, but with an assist from George W. Bush. If Bush and his team hadn't foolishly decided in 2003 to disband the Iraqi army and purge Sunni Baathists from the government, al-Maliki would have found it much harder to pursue his anti-Sunni agenda. Invading Iraq was indeed a grave mistake, said Raihan Salam in Slate.com, but leaving as abruptly as we did was another one. Obama and al-Maliki did discuss leaving a small contingent of U.S. troops in Iraq to ensure stability, but al-Maliki could tell that Obama's heart wasn't in it, so he just walked away from the deal. What Americans left behind was a state that could not stand on its own, said Dexter Filkins in The New Yorker. As a result, everything we built is now coming apart. It's naive to think the U.S. military could have prevented this crack-up, said Gordon Adams in foreignpolicy.com. In the Philippines, Vietnam, Afghanistan, Haiti, and many other nations, the U.S. has failed time and again with both military force and billions in aid to transform troubled corners of the world into peaceful gardens of democracy. Yet some hawks still cling to the blithe American assumption that the U.S. is omnipotent. After 8 bloody and costly years in Iraq, how much longer did we need to stay to work a miracle? 5 years? 20? 50? We should have known better than to try in the first place. Well, it was a good week for playing defense. After 2,592,000 commemorative World Cup condoms were sold in Brazil in 2 weeks. It was a good week for fatalism after Pope Francis announced that he would no longer use the bulletproof Pope Mobile because it's a sardine can that walls him off from the faithful. At my age, said the 77-year-old pontiff, I don't have much to lose. It was a good week for keeping up with the kids after the FBI released the 83-page manual it uses to decipher Twitter slang, which includes common shorthand like LOL, laugh out loud, as well as more unusual acronyms such as TPK, total party kill, and IITYWTMWYBMAD. If I tell you what this means, will you buy me a drink? It was a bad week for toughing it out after a 72-year-old California runner completed a grueling 7.5-mile race over steep terrain despite suffering a heart attack as he ran. My body was not feeling too bad, except for the chest pain, said Wolfgang Zeck after being rushed to the hospital. It was a bad week for playing fireman after a Pennsylvania woman climbed 40 feet up a tree to rescue a stuck cat, only to realize she couldn't make it back down. Firefighters had to rescue both Tara Dennis, 21, and the stranded kitty. Normally, we recommend people just let animals come down by themselves, said a fire official. It was a bad week for loving thy neighbor after a Chicago convent sued a strip club next door, demanding an end to the thumping dance music. The strippers aren't monsters, protested the club's manager. They're daughters, they're mothers, and some of them are Catholics, too. Over on the briefing page, the return of El Nino. A disruptive climate phenomenon is brewing in the Pacific Ocean, and it may cause global havoc. What is El Nino? It's a complex meteorological event that causes hotter temperatures, torrential rain, prolonged droughts, and other extreme weather from Asia to the Americas. Caused by a natural cycle of periodic warming in the Pacific Ocean, El Nino occurs every 2 to 7 years and messes up usual weather patterns for much of the world. Climate experts at the European Center for Medium-Range Weather Forecasts now put the odds of an event occurring this year at 90%. I think there's no doubt that there's an El Nino underway, said Kevin Trenberth of the U.S. National Center for Atmospheric Research. The question is whether it'll be a small or big one. So far, the evidence is mixed, but the water in the tropical Pacific is currently as warm as it was in 1997, the year of the biggest El Nino ever recorded. What happened then? The 1997-98 El Nino was one of only two super El Ninos in the last 150 years, setting off a chain reaction of extreme weather across the globe that caused about $45 billion in damage and 23,000 deaths. Nations in the Western Pacific experienced devastating droughts, said Wenju Cai of the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization, While catastrophic floods occurred in the eastern equatorial region of Ecuador and northern Peru. About $3 billion worth of crops were lost, food prices skyrocketed, and huge forest fires swept through Malaysia, Indonesia, and Brazil. The event was even blamed for a severe outbreak in eastern Africa of Rift Valley fever, a mosquito-transmitted viral disease that spread after weeks of heavy rainfall. What triggers El Niño? El Niño events occur when the strong trade winds blowing from east to west in the Pacific become weaker, causing ocean surface temperatures to rise. When that pool of warm water shifts eastward, atmospheric moisture follows, causing extremely heavy rains in Peru and other parts of South America, and an accompanying drought from Indonesia to Australia. El Niño events don't reach peak strength until December. In fact, El Niño, the boy, or the Christ child in Spanish, was named by Peruvian fishermen who noticed that a warm ocean current tended to materialize off the South American coast during Christmas time. Occasionally, El Niños start to form and then collapse unexpectedly, as one did in 2012. This year's forming El Niño shows no sign of dissipating and may already be affecting the weather. Where is that happening? In India, where June's monsoon rains are currently 40% below average, putting in jeopardy the health of crops in the world's second largest producer of sugar, rice, and wheat. If it is El Niño depriving India of the seasonal rains, then the drought would move through Asia and toward Australia, a country that's already been crippled by a prolonged drought, extreme heat, and raging bushfires. Peru, on the other hand, would experience flooding and a surge in waterborne diseases, as happened when El Niño triggered a cholera epidemic in the country in 1991, and would see its cold water fisheries depleted by a surge of warm ocean currents. What about the U.S.? We might actually benefit. El Niño has a bad connotation, undeservedly so in the U.S., said Harry Hilliker, state climatologist in Iowa. For one thing, El Niño events tend to increase wind shear in the Atlantic, making it more difficult for hurricanes to form and grow during the June to November season. The phenomenon might also bring a milder winter to the north and east of the U.S., providing relief to locals who have had to suffer through crippling polar vortices. More importantly, the weather event could trigger high rainfall in the drought-ravaged state of California, which in 2013 experienced its driest year in recorded history. The downside of that heavier rainfall is that it could lead to major flash flooding and landslides, said Mike Halpert, the acting director of the Federal Climate Prediction Center. But sometimes you have to pick your poison. What about climate change? El Niño and climate change are separate phenomena, but they can feed on each other. New research published in the journal Nature, Climate Changes, indicates that unchecked climate change could double the number of El Niño events. In turn, El Niño may exacerbate the effects of global warming. If the 2014 El Niño is as strong as 1998, it could rapidly boost global temperatures by nearly 0.25 degrees Celsius, making it the hottest year on record. Some meteorologists think a year of extreme heat could affect long-term climate patterns, triggering more rapid warming for years to come. If a strong El Niño does develop in 2014, the hot weather might affect public opinion about climate change, which has grown more skeptical in recent years. As irrational as it may be, said social scientist John Krosnick of Stanford University, millions of Americans form their opinion about climate change based on very recent trends in warming. And 2014 is shaping up to be an extraordinarily warm year. Looking at our columns, we'll take two from the U.S. this week. The first one, from John Fund at nationalreview.com, is titled, Oops, the IRS's missing emails. The IRS scandal is starting to look like Watergate for the digital age, said John Fund. The Obama administration steadfastly insists there is no evidence that political motives drove the Internal Revenue Service to target conservative nonprofit groups for special scrutiny. Now we may know why. The IRS claims a computer crash wiped out 2 years' worth of crucial emails between Lois Lerner, the official at the center of the firestorm, and anyone outside the agency. That means much of the scandal's backstory, who knew about and ordered the special scrutiny of Tea Party groups, may be conveniently lost in a black hole. It's eerily reminiscent of the supposedly accidental 18-and-a-half-minute gap in President Nixon's Watergate tapes. The server ate the emails excuse is even more implausible, since it is IRS policy to be able to back up and recover all electronic records. House committees investigating the IRS should require every agency techie involved in the search for Lerner's email to testify under oath. Perhaps some of them will not want to commit perjury to protect political higher-ups. From Paul Krugman at the New York Times, why liberals should applaud Obama? Why are liberals so disappointed with President Obama? Asked Paul Krugman. The prevailing media narrative is that Obama's presidency has fallen far short of the extravagant hopes of 2008. But presidents should be judged by their achievements, not by unrealistic fantasies, and by that standard, Obama's presidency is a major success. Despite unhinged opposition from Republicans, Obama's health care reform law is now working well. Enrollments came in above projections, the number of uninsured Americans has dropped sharply, and additional insurance companies are jumping into the exchanges to compete for new customers. All great signs for the Affordable Care Act. Obama's new emissions rules for power plants, the most important environmental initiative since the Clean Air Act, mark the first serious attempt to address climate change. Obama's regulatory reforms of Wall Street have enraged the big banks, proof the new rules have teeth. Yes, many Americans are disappointed that Obama didn't manage to make our politics less bitter and polarized. But how is that possible when Republicans were determined to block him from the day one? In the face of their relentless sabotage, Obama has moved the ball down the field. History's verdict will be, yes, he could. And from the international columns, how they see us. Should Iran help the U.S. in Iraq? Does the U.S. want Iran's help in calming the chaotic situation in Iraq? Asked Saeed Sobhani in Resalat from Iran. American diplomats have been dropping hints about a possible alliance all over CNN this past week, as Sunni terrorist group the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria raced toward Baghdad. Yet such a plea for cooperation would be the height of hypocrisy, since the Americans created ISIS in the first place and lent it direct and indirect support. If the U.S. is suddenly upset that ISIS is overrunning Iraq, it has to be seen as a conflict between the U.S. and its trained agents. This is a blatant Western plot to get Iran to intervene, said Mohammad Safari and Siazet-e-Ruz from Iran. The Sunni terrorists have committed barbaric crimes in Iraq, but contrary to Western media reports, they do not actually control entire cities such as Mosul. Western propaganda to that effect, as well as claims that Iranian troops are already fighting in Iraq at request of the country's Shiite-led government, are intended to force Tehran to deal with the terrorists. We won't. Of course, just as the Islamic Republic of Iran did not allow Bashar al-Assad's democratic government to fall in Syria, we will also not let Iraq's democratically elected prime minister, Nouri al-Maliki, be overthrown. But Iran doesn't need to directly interfere in Iraq or send in thousands of troops to ensure that. It's possible to tackle these radicals without America's help, said Haidar Ali Bakrain in Iran. There are plenty of international bodies we can call on. The Organization of the Islamic Conference, for instance, or the United Nations. We could also take joint action with Turkey in limited ways. Something, though, has to be done, because even if ISIS is unlikely to hang on to its gains permanently, its temporary dominance over certain areas of Iraq threatens Iran's security and regional standing. Shiite Iran should take action now, unless it wants a hostile Sunni mini-state on its doorstep, said Ibrahim Karagul and Yeni Safak from Turkey. Far from being just another group of al-Qaeda-inspired terrorists, ISIS is in fact a coalition of Sunni Arab militias that want to create a Sunni Arab statelet in opposition to the Shiite Arab one that rules Baghdad and the Kurdish one that controls Iraqi Kurdistan. Who is behind the project? Saudi Arabia and Qatar and other Sunni Gulf states. They want a Sunni bloc to stand against the Shiite crescent led by Iran, and they may well get one. Already, Iraq is effectively divided into three parts. If Iran and the U.S. don't intervene soon, the division of Iraq will become permanent. We'll turn now to the last word. The last great game show host. The correct response is, who is Alec Trebek? Said Noreen Malone, though he jokes that he's a failure. The set of Jeopardy was given a shiny makeover last year in preparation for the quiz show's 50th birthday. The new look features that familiar top-heavy bubble letter logo and a gorgeously tacky sunset backdrop that provides an odd companion to the sexless blue and white board. In fluorescent spirit, though, the set is unchanged since the 1980s, much like the program itself. Contestants come and go. Some, like this year's star, Arthur Chu, even briefly become big deals. But it is Alex Trebek who has remained the centerpiece. His extended tenure as America's senior-most faculty member has made Americans forget that he's playing a part. A few years ago, Trebek was voted the eighth most trusted person in the United States, sandwiched between Bill and Melinda Gates. He's like a Ward Cleaver figure, said Ken Jennings, the most successful Jeopardy contestant ever. But for the past 30 years, this month, in fact, the host will mark three decades as the face and voice of Jeopardy. Like the show's theme music, he is almost post-iconic, such a known entity that he's just there. He might not be there for much longer, though. Jeopardy continues to draw around 25 million viewers per week, making it second among syndicated game shows, behind only Wheel of Fortune, which Jeopardy fans dismiss as little better than a televised jumble puzzle. But Trebek has hinted that he will retire when his contract runs out in 2016. Already he has outlasted Jay Leno and now David Letterman as one of the final one-man TV brands from the time before DVRs. Audience shares and attention spans, however, aren't the only things that have changed during his run. In the internet era, knowing a little about a lot provides diminished cachet. You don't have to retain facts when they can just be Googled. These days, there's a throwback charm to the whole Jeopardy enterprise and the appeal in Trebek's late career performances of a simple job well done. Trudebec has by now done more than 6,000 shows, read out who knows how many facts, fact after fact after fact. He is a TV star who presides over an assembly line. But a funny thing about the audiences at Jeopardy tapings, the faithful pilgrims who've come to see what it all is like in person, most don't actually look directly at Trebek. As a loping brontosaurus of a camera records the action for broadcast, it also pipes footage onto two jumbo screens that face the audience. It's those monitors that the crowd members keep their eyes locked on, not the man below. Mediated Trebek is the Trebek they are comfortable with, and the one they reflexively watch. The real Trebek does not mind that. Trebek has built his career on an air of erudition, but off-screen he is equally invested in a second persona, one that colleagues say has emerged more in recent years. This other Trebek is much less of a masterpiece theater guy, is how his staffer puts it. He's more of a getting-his-hands-dirty guy. So even as Trebek might casually draw the solar system during conversation, because of course that's a thing the host of Jeopardy would do, he also takes pride in noting that he was almost kicked out of boarding school as a boy. He sometimes brags about his breakfast of Snickers and Diet Pepsi. He has had 2 heart attacks, but sums up his current exercise regimen as, "I drink." Yes, Trebek can describe for you the 1928 Mouton that he once tasted, but he is quick to joke, "I'm not a true wine connoisseur. I'm just a drinker." Fact. According to Trebek, his favorite place in Los Angeles these days is Home Depot. He and his second wife, Jean, whom Trebek married in 1990 when she was 26 and he was a 49-year-old divorcee, live in a nice house in the valley, and he spends a great deal of time thinking about maintenance and improvements. Trebek says that when he gets up in the middle of the night, he has terrible insomnia, he will lie awake for hours plotting how to fix the sliver of light peeking through his window and all the other home repair projects he wants to tackle next. Trebek grew up in Sudbury, Ontario. During his college days at the University of Ottawa, he held down jobs at both a local radio and TV station, scrambling around town to avoid missing classes or shifts. He got his start as a host in 1963 when he was cast to MC a Canadian program called Music Hop. He was 33 when he moved to Hollywood to helm The Wizard of Odds on NBC. Clips of his early work show a natural performer. All elements of the singular Trebekian delivery, crisp enunciation, acrobatic inflections, hammy dignity are there, along with a not-yet-faded accent. When Jeopardy hired Trebek as host in 1984, the franchise was emerging from nearly a decade off the air. The show had been the creation of Julon Griffin, wife of game show impresario Merv Griffin, who dreamed up the format while quiz shows were recovering from the 1950s cheating scandal at the $64,000 question and 21. Her insight was that the game could not appear to be rigged if you went ahead and gave the answers to the contestants and asked them to supply the questions instead. Trebek added that his showman's knack for drawing out contenders and filling silences with easy patter. He quickly propelled Jeopardy to a level of popularity never achieved under his now-forgotten predecessor. The correct response to a very hard final round clue would be, "Who is Art Fleming?" In their early years, quiz shows were a platform for striving immigrants to show themselves as the intellectual equals of establishment WASPs, or at least gain some recognition for their smarts. Jeopardy came out of that tradition, and as mass culture coarsened, it stood as an archipelago of aspirational dweebiness in a sea of hair metal music videos and prime time soaps. But if Jeopardy once stood athwart history yelling, "Stop!" and rewarded those able to recall who originally coined that phrase, There is plenty of fodder for declinists in the gradual devolution of what the show considers cultural literacy. Today's game features far fewer questions in subjects like philosophy or classical music, statistically the most difficult categories. A recent Time study plumbing the trove of Jeopardy data maintained on a fan site called J-Archive showed that references to Albert Einstein peaked 15 years ago. Newer episodes reference Justin Bieber more than twice as often. During the tapings I watched, there was a question about twerking, which Miley Cyrus had just weeks earlier brought into the baby boomer vernacular via her performance at the Video Music Awards. No contestant got a question about Samuel Coleridge correct, which might have been less noteworthy if they hadn't been so quick to buzz in with, "Who is Dan Brown?" on the clue directly preceding it. A recent category, It's a Rap, required Trebek to spit verse, "Ain't nothing but a G-thang," he gamely recited, his diction as sharp-cornered as ever. It was funny. According to head writer Billy Wise, Jeopardy is merely adjusting along with the evolving canon. His team needs to write the game so that contestants will still have a shot at knowing the answers. Just as important, they have to ensure that the people playing along at home still get to feel good about their intellects. "They don't know as much about Theodore Dreiser as they used to," Wise said. It's sad, but it's so big that it seems a shame to mourn for it. There's not much anyone can do. Lately, Trebek's insomnia has grown more severe. His hairdresser, Renee, who refers to herself as his second wife, nags him affectionately to take his Z-Quil, but he forgets. He'll sometimes have been up for hours by the time he heads to the set. Before the day's tapings begin, Trebek and the staff of Jeopardy meet in a time-worn room kitted out like a middle school library, with a whole bookshelf stuffed with bright yellow volumes from the For Dummies series. People who come to work at Jeopardy tend to stay. Trebek and the producers are good bosses, everyone says, so the show's employees are a little older and dowdier than might be found on other Culver City lots. The questions, which Trebek doesn't write but will edit or spike as he sees fit, have been drafted long before the sessions. This is rehearsal time, and Trebek uses it to go over things like pronunciation and pacing. As he will admit without being asked, he would not know all the answers without the script in front of him. Trebek's wife is serious about her church, the North Hollywood Church of Religious Science, and church friends are the core of the Trebek's social life, he says, a big shift from the bachelor years when he tooled around Hollywood in a Bentley convertible. Mostly, he unwinds by watching television. Breaking Bad and Deadwood are recent favorites. The Lakers, a constant. He follows the Redskins and doesn't think they should change their name. "They weren't called the Redskins because we thought Redskins were terrible. It's because we admire their strength, their abilities," he says. One day, Trebek had on Fox News in the background. Somebody was saying on television a few days ago that the Tea Party is a reflection of the people. There are a lot of people out there who are not happy with the way things are going, and they banded together, he told me later, though he declined to reveal whom he voted for in the last presidential election, and when pressed, said he's apolitical. Fact. When Trebek shaved off his mustache in 2001, he did it in the middle of the day, himself, without warning the Jeopardy producers. Renee was alarmed to come in and find him mid-shearing. "He just felt like it," he says now. "And it got so much press, I couldn't believe it. The war's with Iraq or whatever at the time, and all the people are in a stew over my mustache. I have one response. Get a life." When Trebek was growing up, he said not long into our first conversation, he wanted to be the Prime Minister of Canada, or a doctor, or an actor. He likes to tell Jeopardy audiences that because he's achieved none of them, he's a failure. "Gets a laugh," he told me. By the time I stood in his dressing room during a lunch break between shows one day, I'd heard him say it twice. He was sitting in a white T-shirt, a hint of tummy showing, and so I asked, "Was there any truth to the joke?" When something is important enough to you, you do it. So obviously, if I haven't done it, it's because maybe it wasn't all that important to me. The secret to happiness, of course, is not getting what you want. It's wanting what you get, he added. Fact. That piece of wisdom, according to Google, originated with one Rabbi Hyman Schachtel. This came from a longer article that originally appeared at newrepublic.com. I have two obituaries this week that I thought you might enjoy. The first is the activist actress who stood up for civil rights, Ruby Dee, 1922 to 2014. Ruby Dee discovered at an early age how hard it was for a black actress to land a decent part. When she tried to audition for a high school play, the head of the drama club turned her away, saying there were no roles for maids. "I never inquired again," she said. Instead, Dee began seeking out deeper roles that defied segregation-era racial stereotypes, and in the process became one of American drama's most celebrated performers, as well as a formidable force in the civil rights movement. "Black women fall in love and have adventures and secrets," she said in 1970, "and are just as driven and gutsy as a lot of white ladies in middle America." Raised in Harlem, Dee started acting in 1940 with the American Negro Theater, a troupe whose members included Sidney Poitier, Harry Belafonte, and Hilda Sims. In 1946, she landed a key role in Jeb, a short-lived Broadway play about a black war hero coming home. Ossie Davis, who played the lead, initially struck her as a gawky bumpkin in ill-fitting clothes, said the Los Angeles Times. "The truth is, he was an intellectual," she said, and the couple married in 1948 between rehearsals for another play. Dee moved to acting in films and became known for her quietly commanding presence opposite powerful leading men, said the Washington Post. She gained national attention in 1950 as Jackie Robinson's supportive wife, Rachel, in the Jackie Robinson story. The famous ballplayer played himself and appeared opposite Poitier in the Broadway and 1961 film versions of A Raisin in the Sun. Dee's career as an actress paralleled her work as an activist, said the New York Daily News. Together with Davis, she picketed Broadway theaters that didn't employ black actors, demonstrated against the Vietnam War, and emceed Martin Luther King Jr.'s 1963 March on Washington. In 2005, Dee received a Lifetime Achievement Award from the National Civil Rights Museum. "You can only appreciate freedom," she said, "when you find yourself in a position to fight for someone else's freedom and not worry about your own." Our second obituary, the DJ who democratized rock and roll, Casey Kasem, 1932 to 2014. For more than three decades, Casey Kasem was the voice of pop music. Millions of listeners would tune in to his American Top 40 radio show each week to hear the peppy disc jockey count down through the country's hit singles in a husky tenor. In between songs, he'd connect lyrics to a listener's uplifting or tear-jerking tale of love or loss, or offer up an intriguing nugget of pop trivia. Then it was on to the next track. And no matter whether the artist was Marvin Gaye, Nirvana, or Britney Spears, Kasem presented them all with equal respect. "I just felt it was my job to show that there is no easy way to success," he said, "and that anyone who gets even just one top 40 hit deserves their moment in the sun." Born in Detroit to Lebanese immigrants, Kasem was drafted by the military while in college and began his broadcasting career spinning bebop jazz for Armed Forces Radio in Korea. When he returned to the U.S., said NPR.org, he perfected his sound at radio stations around the country before launching American Top 40 from California in 1970. The syndicated show, a four-hour feast of homey sentiment and American optimism, ran counter to the prevailing spirit of cynicism and rebellion, said the New York Times. While hip FM disc jockeys were increasingly playing their favorite album tracks, Kasem featured only the singles that Billboard magazine ranked as the most popular that week, based on an analysis of airplay. A playlist, in effect, based on the national pop consensus. American Top 40 debuted on five radio stations, and by the mid-70s had reached nearly 1,000 outlets. Yet Kasem, who retired from the show in 2004, was not certain that his radio work was how he would be best remembered, said the Washington Post. He had a long career doing voiceovers for commercials and cartoons, most famously his voicing the hippie detective Shaggy in the Scooby-Doo series. They are going to be playing Shaggy and Scooby-Doo for eons, he said in 2004, and they're going to forget Casey Kasem unless they happen to step on his star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. On the health and science page, NASA can't afford a Mars mission. NASA won't be capable of a manned mission to Mars anytime in the foreseeable future. That's the conclusion from a panel of experts asked to review the feasibility of President Obama's declared goal of reaching the red planet by the 2030s. Funding is a chief obstacle, with the space agency's annual budget of $17.5 billion expected to remain unchanged in coming years. Such funding levels, the report warned, invite failure, disillusionment, and the loss of long-standing international perception that human spaceflight is something the United States does best. Several presidents have talked in vague terms about sending manned missions to Mars sometime in the future, but panel member and Cornell University astronomer Jonathan I. Lunine tells the New York Times, there is not a believable plan for getting there. The panel was convinced by the National Research Council at the request of Congress and delivered a 286-page report after 18 months of deliberation. The experts advised setting intermediate goals, dubbed stepping stones, that would aid in eventual human exploration of the red planet. One such stepping stone could be establishing a manned base on the moon to develop and test the technologies necessary for long-haul missions. NASA is currently designing a new class of rocket that will be capable of lifting heavy equipment into space, but there is no planned mission beyond Earth's orbit. Rats think twice. Regret, or the ability to recognize that different choices would have resulted in better outcomes, was once thought to be a uniquely human emotion. But a new study indicates that rats may experience it as well, said Wired.com. Researchers set up a circuit of four restaurants offering various flavors of food and trained the rats to recognize that different audio tones indicated different wait times. Hearing a specific tone outside a restaurant, the rats could choose to stay or move on. In 1 hour on the circuit, the rats demonstrated individual preferences, waiting for some foods and not others. But more revealing was the way they reacted when they chose poorly. They stopped, looked backward, often ate quickly, and rushed to the next station, and were more likely to wait longer once they got there. In contrast, rats that chose wisely tended to rest and groom themselves between meals. The rats that made bad choices also experienced neural activity in the orbitofrontal cortex, the same part of the brain where humans register regret. We know their brains are doing the same calculation, said University of Minnesota neuroscience professor David Reddish, measuring the what might have been that humans do when we feel regret. On the Talking Points page, World Cup, America versus soccer. 1 billion people may be watching the ongoing World Cup, said Stephen Moore in FoxNews.com, but I won't be one of them. The reasons are obvious. I'm an American. I want scoring. I want action. Soccer matches have little of either, and if a team goes up 2-0, it's like being down 49-0 in real, that is, American, football. The only entertainment comes when players theatrically flop to the ground, crying for a foul. We Americans who do not care about the World Cup are still in the majority, said Alexandra Petri in WashingtonPost.com. And why should we care? The World Cup is explicitly un-American, since it has the word world in its name, and we have zero chance of winning. If I wanted to spend 90 minutes watching foreigners beating us embarrassingly, I would just leaf very slowly through our students' international math and science test results. You've got it all wrong, said Sean Wilsey in thedailybeast.com. The World Cup is a wildly colorful display of pageantry and national pride, with fans painting their faces in their team's colors and weeping openly at victories. Then there are the unexpected greatnesses of the beautiful game itself, the leaping headers, curling corners, and soaring shots, all gloriously epitomized when an overexcited announcer shouts, "Goal!" More and more Americans are catching the bug, said Andres Martinez in Time.com. Far more people in the U.S. watched the 2010 World Cup final than the decisive fifth game of the World Series that year. And American kids now routinely wear jerseys of teams in places like Barcelona. Slowly but surely, America is being conquered by the world sport. I hope not, said Jonathan Clegg in WSJ.com. Growing up as a soccer fan in England, I've watched my fair share of horrors. Wild riots, abusive chants, slurring drunkenness, but nothing is as bad as the obnoxious American soccer obsessive. These newbies express their soccer fandom as an elaborate piece of performance art, pretentiously referring to the sport as football, and proudly wearing their team scarves even in 90-degree heat. Worse, while fans of other nations approach World Cup games with anxiety, fearing national humiliation, the nouveau American soccer fan seems bafflingly upbeat about the whole thing. We'll see how irritatingly optimistic you are after the USA faces Germany. Speaking of soccer, we have a couple of soccer notes. On days when their team is playing in the World Cup, men are 3.26 times more likely than normal to have a heart attack, according to a German study of hospitalizations during the 2006 World Cup. For women, the risk is 1.82 times higher. Watching the games not only produces stress in rabid fans, the study found, but it's also associated with lack of sleep, overeating, consumption of junk food, heavy alcohol ingestion, and smoking. The opening match of the World Cup last week, Brazil's 3-1 defeat of Croatia, generated 58 million comments and more than 140 million interactions on Facebook. That's nearly five times as many posts for ABC's Oscars telecast in March. A few other notes. Here's a couple of business notes. Protein is getting pricey. The cost of beef, beans, bacon, and nine other protein sources jumped 28% in the last 5 years, In 2014 alone, protein prices have risen roughly 5%, twice the pace of increases for any other food group. Airline fares have jumped 6% in May, marking the largest single month-to-month increase since 1999. The Great Recession led to more than 10,000 economic suicides in North America and Europe between 2007 and 2010, according to a new study of the British Journal of Psychiatry. Researchers said the spike in suicide rates was sparked by job losses, plummeting stocks, dwindling pensions, and diminished house prices. Volunteers who clean a 10-mile stretch of Hawaii Island's beaches pick up about 20 tons of trash a year that arrives from the Pacific Ocean. In the most recent cleanup, the haul included 191,739 plastic fragments, 562 bottle or container caps, 93 toothbrushes, 64 beverage bottles, 3 refrigerator doors, and 3 G.I. Joe toys. Over on the poll watch, 42% of Americans say they admire Bill Clinton more than any other president in the last 25 years. 18% most admire Barack Obama, while 17% named George W. Bush, and 16% named George H.W. Bush. Despite the growth of the U.S. professional league and frequent telecast of matches in England and other countries, only 28% of Americans are fans of professional soccer, down from 31% in 1994. 49% think that the sport is boring. And we'll wrap it up with a quote today from Rita Mae Brown, quoted in the Nashville Tennessean. "Happiness is pretty simple. Someone to love, something to do, and something to look forward to." Good note to end it on. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. The program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.